Well, some of you may have wondered if I wrote out that introduction. I think I should tell you I've been writing Cecil's editorials for a long time. But more relevant to the situation, I waited for my opportunity to come to the Minnesota Press Club when you had a president that I could rely upon. A man with total objectivity. Namely, I'm the object of his affection. And I want you to know, Cecil, that in the presence of your peers and your associates, that I cherish our friendship. And I admire you as one of our outstanding citizens, not only of the state of city of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota, but I want to tell you he's a great citizen of the United States, a wonderful man. Now, I was asked to touch my topic, and I said, well, I haven't figured that out yet. I was sitting here chewing on that chicken sandwich and trying to figure out what I might say in these, what were termed in the letter that I received as off-the-cuff remarks. Now, you know what that means. Just lean back. Because my off-the-cuff remarks almost take off the shirt before you're through. But I'll try to keep within the limits that are somewhat traditional for this club. I know that you have questions, some of you, that you want to ask, and I want to say I'm going to avoid as many as I can. I don't want to engage in a filibuster, but if I had some idea what you were going to ask, it could determine the length of my remarks at this occasion. Truly, I'm looking forward to your questions. I noticed the sign in the room off to my left and to your right. It says President's Room, and I want you to notice I kept out of that. So, let's have no questions on that subject whatsoever. I sat out here with just the poor overburdened taxpayer and citizen out here with the folks. I don't know who those folks are back there. They're in the President's Room, but I think I'll take a peek and see whether or not they're up to standard, and if they're not, I may move in any time. First, let me tell you that I am very pleased to be invited, and I am honored to be included amongst your list of... I found that wherever we went, despite differences of political opinion, we were received graciously, kindly, and warmly by people of different political persuasions. Not once was there a single instance of ill manners, unkindness, or discourtesy. Every place it was always a friendly reception. And of course, the nicest reception of all was the vote tally. Cecil started out his introduction by reminding me of more difficult days. Somebody said that in defeat you can build character, and I said at one occasion like this that I think that you can also build a lot of character in victory, and if I have a choice, I prefer to build it in victory. Now, I'm going to just visit with you and see if we can come to some, make this this period of time somewhat worthwhile. As I sat here at the table, I remembered what Charles Dickens said. I think it was in The Tale of Two Cities. These are the best of times, and these are the worst of times. And there you have it. That's my message for today. These are, in many ways, the best of times, and you know it. Those of us of my age group know that in many ways these are the best of times, even when they're not so good. And yet we also know these are the worst of times. And I thought I'd just take that theme, which passed through my mind quickly here today, and see if I couldn't develop a little dialogue with you, a little discussion around it. So let me turn it around for a moment and take the latter rather than the former first. These are the worst of times. Because you generally get a little more attention, you know, if you point out what's bad and what's gone wrong. And frankly, to know how to heal oneself, you need to know what your illness is. In order to find yourself, you have to know yourself. In order to know the nation, you must know not only its strengths, but you must know its weaknesses. And may I say that the real test of a nation's strength, or a community's strength, or an individual's strength, is his willingness or its willingness to admit weakness, but not to accept it, to understand it, and to come to grips with it. I've always been a little more concerned about people and worried about people who seem to be so confident, who in a sense were, almost immodest, filled with undue pride, boisterous, braggadocio. Those people really do not have confidence, nor does a nation have confidence, when it exemplifies and when it articulates only its power, its strength, its wealth, its riches, its glory. Because none of us are quite that good. So, in the words of Scripture and all, we have to heal ourselves. In order to heal ourselves, we have to know what's wrong. Now, I don't think we always know what's wrong, but I think we as a people, more than as a government, have a capacity to understand and to realize what's wrong. This is what this last campaign meant to me. Now, I want you to know that I hadn't planned on being home here these last 2 years. You know that. This was an enforced sabbatical. But due to the Constitution and the electorate, I came back to Minnesota in the winter of 1969, January 1969. And I had the privilege of teaching at two of our great institutions of higher education, the University of Minnesota and McAllister College. I also had the privilege of being associated with a very fine business firm, a company in the field of education, Encyclopedia Britannica. I traveled widely through our nation and abroad on missions of both commerce and education. And I visited a number of our universities during these 2 years. Now, I realized that I was also a target. I was a member of the Johnson administration. They called it the Johnson-Humphrey administration. I noticed whenever we were in trouble, they called it Johnson-Humphrey. Whenever things were going well, it was the Johnson administration. But during that period of 2 years, I learned a great deal because I wanted to learn a great deal. I shall really take my hair down to you today, what's left of it. When I first came back to teach, I don't think I was a very good teacher because I still was in the role of a vice president, an advocate, defensive, trying to explain, in a sense trying to vindicate. And I want to tell you something. Any public official that tries to vindicate himself is a lost cause. You cannot ever vindicate. If you do, you take others down with you. And it didn't take me long after the candor of my students to find out that it was better to just face up to the criticisms that people were willing to make, and not only willing, but were anxious to make. And to try to understand their point of view and to try to search out new ground, new ideas, and to communicate as best we could. Now, this is what I tried to do during these last 2 years. And after a few weeks, and it only took a few weeks, maybe 2 or 3 months, I began to feel I had a new feeling about myself and about my role in life. I began to understand that humans are fallible, not infallible, that political decisions are not always understood and sometimes are not understandable, that you do make mistakes, and that we often fail in communication. And I set out on a course of trying to learn from my students, and I said that I thought I would learn more than I was able to teach, and I think I did. But significantly, I learned more from people who are non-students. And one of the great joys of the campaign was just being out to see the people, to listen to them. I just left this morning the League of Women Voters, the Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce, yesterday the Minnesota League of Municipalities, different other groups have been coming in to see me, labor, agriculture, business, civic groups. And I've had the privilege once again of hearing what they have to say. And the trouble with those of us who are long-term public officials is that we tend to live with other public officials. And we tend to get information that is screened. It's inevitable. It's not premeditated. It is not as if somebody didn't want to know and didn't want to get the facts and didn't want to understand. It's just that there's only so much time in a day, there's only so many days in a week, in a month, in a year, and you listen to those that are closest at hand. And it's difficult to break out of the compound. And this is what happens to a president and to a vice president. They are trapped, in a sense, in a compound. One of the things that I want to compliment Mr. Nixon upon is doing what I recommended to him in the campaign, namely getting out to the people. I said that if elected, I would have what we call an open presidency, to go to the people. And I think that the president, as much as a president can do it, has gone out to the people. I really believe this is important. Of course, he makes the most of it, as any man should in his position. But there is a tendency when you're under great pressure and difficulty to hold up, to just stay in your office, to stay with your closest advisors, and those advisors become fewer and fewer as the pressure gets on. Well, I had the chance to get out, forcibly, I might add. But rather than to look upon that experience as a failure, I looked upon it as an opportunity. I have many people say to me, well, didn't it break your heart losing the presidential election? Yes, it did. Very candidly, it did. But it heals. It leaves scar tissue, but it heals. The important thing was not to moan and groan over it. I learned a great deal from people. Don't listen, I learned more about unemployment, more about the economy, more about the problems of the children with drugs and drug abuse, more about the difficulties of education, right out here talking to your neighbors and to some of you, than I've learned in all of my formal education and all of the government reports that I've read, and I've read volumes of them. I consume them like a hungry child. I've eaten them up, so to speak. But to stand out at one of these shopping centers and talk to people all day long, and to have them tell you what's on their heart, and to listen to the personal confession, so to speak, and the personal and the revelation of personal difficulties, the intimacy that they demonstrate by their words and their actions, is a wonderful thing. So I know a little bit about our country and our state, and I intend to put it to good use. I intend to put it to very good use. I go back to the Senate not to get any titles. I want you to make it clear before we start. I don't seek to be any official in the Senate except United States Senator from the state of Minnesota. I have many people say, well, now, my best friends, they say, well, now Humphrey's going back, we'll get things all straightened out. No, folks, that isn't going to happen that quick. I don't intend to mount the dome of the Capitol and say, here I am. Let there be peace. I don't intend to say that. And what's more, I couldn't do it anyway. I intend to go back as a working senator, and I have to tell you in all candor that it will be a difficult assignment. I know that this is a unique situation, and in a sense, I'm a unique person. I am the first man in the history of this country that ever was senator for 3 terms, vice president of the United States, candidate for president, and returned to the Senate. No other time has this ever happened. And I know senators pretty well. I've been one of them myself. There are 100 super equals. It's 100 super equals. And they don't intend to have anybody come on in and say, well, here comes Mr. Big. As a matter of fact, they'll shoot you down before you get through the door, in more ways than one. So I have, as I told a group of reporters in Washington, I come in a very awkward situation, but thank God I've had training in awkwardness. And I have had some. That's right. Now, what are some of these problems that I call that make for the worst of times? Well, you know them. There is alienation in the country. There's alienation between some of the people in our races. We're a heterogeneous society. It isn't just black and white. May I say to my fellow Americans in this room, this is the only so-called representative free society in the world that has a heterogeneous population. This is the world's greatest experiment. It has never succeeded before, you know. Never in the history of mankind has there been a government or a social structure or called a society that has been able to hold together over any period of time made up of different races, creeds, and nationalities. So you're living through one of the greatest experiments that the world has ever known. And just keep it in mind that you're dealing with volatile, explosive social factors. And if you understand that, then you won't expect too much tranquility. You won't expect everything will be too well organized, sophisticated, refined. Why, even under forms of dictatorship, where the police power can be generously and is generously used, a heterogeneous society has been impossible. Take a look at the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Back in the, some of you early students of history, back in the days of the early days of the 1900s, the Ottoman Empire, of course, the Roman Empire. There is another heterogeneous society called the Soviet Union, but it isn't quite as open and quite as free as this society. And it has its troubles. So I put that down first. A heterogeneous society that is always difficult to manage, to coordinate, to hold together, to bring to common purpose. Then we've lived through the most incredible period of violence that the world has ever known. And I'm not talking about street crime now. I'm talking about the violence that has fractured the total political social structure of the world. Let's get a little perspective on where we are. Then we won't give up. World War II, following World War I, in the lifetime of men in this room, both of them, tore a whole globe apart. And then smaller wars, but yet tragic ones. Korean, Southeast Asia, Middle East crisis, one after another. As a matter of fact, there's been very little peace on earth, and all too little goodwill towards men since the beginning of recorded history. The years of peace in recorded history are so few that they're almost unmentionable in terms of their numbers. Then add to that, if you please, the incredible mobility of people that has come by transportation. I look out here and I take a look at the automobile that has literally revolutionized, basically altered American society. Most of the many of the problems you have today is due to the automobile. Yet we wouldn't want to be without them. Whole cities are changed because of the automobile. Whole industries are changed. Whole businesses are changed. Social habits, moral values have changed. The mobility of people. I don't mean just the automobile. The airplane, the bus, the fast transportation, mass transit, what have you. The atomic age. Now your children are required to live through all of this. Some of us have lived through all of it. Is it any wonder that they are somewhat perplexed, confused? There is nothing today that is really set, stable. Everything is under suspicion. Everything is being contested. This is why there's alienation. Because when you're not sure of your values, when you're not sure of your institutions, when you're not sure of your neighbors, it's difficult to have trust. And without trust, there is doubt, suspicion, and alienation. And without trust, it's very difficult to manage, or to develop, I should say, to organize, to develop, to hold together a free society. Violence and crime are the product of this. Somebody said to me, when do you think it'll lessen? I said, when people become more confident of one another. When whole new social structures are developed. When people begin to feel that there are roots. It isn't just enough to have more police, even though that's required, and better police. And it isn't just enough to have better courts and more judges and penal reform and rehabilitation, and all of this is required. But you and I know that that is not quite enough. There is no amount of antiseptic or disinfectant that abolishes disease. You have to build a healthy body. No matter how much penicillin you take, no matter how many antibiotics, no matter how much disinfectant and antiseptic, you cannot live in a healthy state unless you have a healthy body, a healthy mind. No matter how many police, no matter how many courts, no matter how many prisons, no matter how many penal reforms, until we build a healthy social structure in which people feel that they have a role, a part, in which they feel they're wanted and needed and trusted and have a place, until we build that, there will not be what we call tranquility and peace. Remember, the Constitution of the United States didn't assure us of tranquility.
It said that we were to seek it, the purpose of government, the more perfect union. We organized to build a more perfect union. And remember, that Constitution is written in the present. We, the people of these United States, do ordain and establish today, this hour, this minute, not 1789, right now. We do ordain and establish, and we do seek to provide and to promote domestic tranquility. Now, hopefully, let's hope, other serious problems, urban crisis. Most of our people are moving to cities, and let's face it, that's what's happening. The trouble is, we're not facing it. We're not dealing with the realities of demography. We're not facing up to the facts of the movement of people. Our cities have far outgrown their capacity to govern, because we haven't developed governmental institutions for the year 1970, the year 2000. We've developed governmental institutions for the year 1850, 1900. Most of the charters of the cities of the United States today were for cities that are not alive today, that are non-existent. And most of the state governments of the United States are designed for times that no longer exist. And this is one of the reasons for the concentration of power in Washington, because there at least they feel that maybe out of the massive resources of the federal government, something can happen. I say to you today that there is a crisis of government in the United States. This is why I want to get back to Washington. Not because I can heal it, but because I want to be involved in its solution. The federal system is in dire trouble. It doesn't require a new constitution, it just requires a new sense of awareness and reality. I don't think we need to write a new document. What I think we need to do is adapt ourselves to the times in which we live, and to quit pretending that somehow or another we were born in log cabins. It's good to have these nice, fond recollections of days gone, but there are days to come. And instead of going back to what it was, it's going to entirely new systems, new developments, new social structures. This is why young people today they're upsetting us. I know that. Most of the parents are very upset with their young. And the reason is, the parents themselves are upset, but they're much more inhibited than their children. Young people are emancipated in a sense today. Young people are saying frequently at a university and a college exactly what their parents are thinking, but their parent doesn't say it unless it caused some trouble on the job or at home or in the club or someplace else. The kids don't worry about that now, and they also say it in a way that just upsets you, because they enjoy this advocacy relation, this adversary relationship with the parents. One of the advantages of being a grandparent with grandchildren is you have a common enemy, the parent. Now, I'm not going to give you my peroration on the crisis of government, but I think it's here. And I want to tell you something, that just as the fingers of the hand and the arm are those which manipulate the gadgetry of our time, so local government is the fingers of the state and the national government. And if these fingers become paralyzed or weakened, nothing happens. And all over America today, there is a crisis of government. Not only a crisis of government in terms of money and revenues, which is surely evident, but government today is muscle-bound, it's big, it's costly, it's unresponsive, and there are so many units of it that people no longer know where to turn when they've got a complaint. And if they do register a complaint, it takes forever, it seems, for any responsiveness from any responsible agency of government. This is why your congressmen and senators are laughed at for being what they call errand boys. The reason they're errand boys is they're the only ones that have the know-how and the muscle at times, the strength to break through the incredible mass of bureaucracy that denies a citizen his right to be heard, that denies him some redress for grievance. And I believe in government being responsive to the cry and the plea of a citizen. Now, what can we do about it? Well, let me just put it quickly. First of all, this is the only industrialized nation on the face of the earth that has no planning Oh, I know you don't like to hear that word, planning, but you don't mind it so much now as it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, if you said planning, they said socialist. That doesn't even frighten anybody now. You're lucky if you get by with just a socialist these days. But this is the only modern industrialized nation on the face of the earth without any planning at a governmental level. Now, if you think you can get by with this, my fellow taxpayers, then you got more money than I think you have. You wouldn't permit for one single minute your businesses to operate this way. The last planning agency of this government was in 1940, the National Resources Planning Board, and it was abolished. Today, what little planning, if any, there is by an agency called the Bureau of the Budget, locked up in a building in Washington that is supposed to have a passion for anonymity. You don't even know who's there. I'm not about ready to turn over my whatever planning that we ought to have to a group of faceless people. I know the Bureau of the Budget's made up of good people, but I want them some public responsibility. Accountability, that's what I'm talking about. I'm going to propose, when I get back to Congress, a joint committee of the Congress on goals and priorities. Because then I'll hear from you, and I'll hear from people, and we'll hear from each other. I don't say that the joint committee on goals and priorities will give me a blueprint for the future, but it will be a sounding board. It'll be a chance for people to be heard and to somehow or another to draw together the great needs of this country and also to hear about our resources. And I think we need a comparable instrumentality at the executive level. I think, for example, one other thing about we need to do is that the budget process of the government, this is the nitty-gritty of government, it ought to be open. Now, your president's going to present to the Congress of the United States within a month and a half a federal budget of over $200 billion. Far over that. It'll be about, well, in terms of the total expenditures and outlays of government and intakes, around over about $275 billion with Social Security and everything in it. Now, my fellow Americans, is there a person in this room of intelligent citizens that has the slightest idea how that budget was put together or who had the input into it? Did you? Did any governor? Did any mayor? Did any legislator? Did the Chamber of Commerce? Did the AFL-CIO? Did the National Farmers Organization, the Farm Bureau? No. That budget is prepared in-house as if it were a secret document. In a most dramatic phrase, I'm familiar with the system. Now, this is the way it's been done for years. I think that when you start to take 1/4 of the total gross national product and put it into a federal budget, the citizenry has a right to know something about it before it's locked up, before it's put with the presidential seal on it and delivered to the Congress. Because I've been in Congress 16 years and there isn't a variation of 2%. Of the budget from what the president presents and what the Congress finally approves. I want to have a chance on the takeoffs rather than the crash landings. And we're going to have to do something about that. It's going to take some time. We're going to need revenue sharing. Now, if you want better local government and stronger local government, we're going to have to give local government the funds to operate and then hold them accountable. And I don't care whether the Republicans claim this is their idea or not, even if it isn't. Let's quit all that nonsense. The election's over. The main thing, let's get it done. And a revenue sharing isn't $500 million for 50 states in a nation of 205 million people. I'm an old pharmacist, you know. There's no use of taking 5,000 units of penicillin and a cough drop. It won't cure anything. If you're going to use penicillin or an antibiotic, take a large enough dose to get some good out of it. The therapeutic effect. And revenue sharing, just as a token payment, all it will do is to tie down some of the inadequacies and inefficiencies in present local and state government. What you need to do is to tie it in a big enough package and have some standards on it so you get some performance. We're going to do something about that. Well, I'm not going to keep you. One other thing that I thought I might want to do, we have ambassadors in different countries, you know, and that ambassador to France is the president's representative in France to coordinate all of U.S. government activities in France. Now, right here in the city of Minneapolis, and we're in the region here, in a federal region, we have all kinds of federal agencies. Their big offices are in Kansas City or Chicago. Now, I've dealt with federal agencies, ladies and gentlemen, and it's easier to deal with separate members of the United Nations. Federal agencies feel a sense of sovereign autonomy. They get their budget, and I swear that they forget that that money comes from the same taxpayer. They get their budget, and this is one of the reasons we had hunger in this country. There'd be extra money over in one department, but the Department of Agriculture didn't have enough. So people went hungry, even though we had food stacked up all over. I think that what we need in every region in this country is a presidential representative that can cut through the red tape, that can knock heads together, that can say to the Department of Labor, the HEW and HUD and others, listen, you boys are just working for the man in the White House and he's working for the people, and we're going to see that the city of Minneapolis or whatever city it is that has a project down here gets some action and quit fooling around as if somehow or another this program was not their program and our program. I think we can do it. Now, what about the best of times? This is the best of times. Oh, I'd have hate to have been a young man back in the late 1800s. I wouldn't have wanted to be at my age in the 1910. This is the best of times. And the reason is that things are happening.